The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Like the energy you experience after a breath of fresh air the morning after a heavy storm, you are now Skeptically Speaking, the show where we ask you to call in and question everything, especially tomorrow's forecast.
Thanks, Sean. So, everybody, it's the episode you've all been waiting for, Storm Chasing. We will soon be on the line with Jeff Richardson, an actual storm chaser. Yes, he's one of those people that actually follows around tornadoes. And I, for those of you on Twitter, I posted a YouTube video today about a ridiculously extreme storm-chasing experience. I hope you enjoyed that. So all your weather-related questions will be answered momentarily. But first, we actually have Speaking Up this week with Amy Davis-Roth of Surly Ramix.
Hello!
Thank you very much for being a part of Skeptically Speaking.
Thank you so much for having me.
So last week we had a microbe-inspired clothing show with Sabina of thephage.com, and this week we have you in your wonderfully skeptical jewelry.
Yeah, Surly Ramix, I can give you a quick rundown if you like, is handmade ceramic jewelry. It's basically an art project that was started by my husband Johnny and myself. And what began as art for the sake of making art and a way to pay the bills has grown in a few directions. And one of those directions is a line of jewelry that we're very proud of called Smart Jewelry that's inspired by science and the skeptical movement.
So now, so this is a segment of a larger line that you have, the Smart Jewelry.
Yeah, we have hundreds and hundreds of different designs. But we are really happy with our skeptical line and our smart jewelry, and our goal with that is to encourage skepticism and critical thinking and the use of science and the scientific method as a means for interpreting the natural world. And we hope to celebrate other skeptics, and we hope to open a dialogue with people that see the jewelry on skeptics so that then they'll start asking questions about the skeptical movement. And I myself personally have been so inspired by skeptics and science, and it's really changed my life in so many ways that we just wanted to find a way where we could use what we do as artists to encourage other people to get interested in the movement as well.
So has this process actually increased your involvement with the skeptical community?
I'm not really sure. I fell so in love with the skeptic movement. I didn't know there was such a thing a few months back. It was news to me. I stumbled upon some scientific information, I guess you could say, some different movies and videos and things about physics, and that's how I originally became interested in the movement. And then I found different podcasts, and it opened up this whole huge world for me. So what things like what you're doing right now with the radio show is so fantastic, because you're reaching people that normally don't have a background in science or don't know anything about the skeptical movement, and you're opening doors for people like me to get involved, and it's really fantastic. So, yeah, I guess I am more involved now than I was before, but it's only because I'm just so excited about the whole thing.
No, and that's fantastic.
I love it. I love everything about the skeptical movement. I love that it helps you to understand how the world works and what's true and what's not true. It's just fantastic.
Well, so is this how you're recruiting to the movement? Like, get them in with the pretty jewelry? Is this subversive?
Well, I think that all of us have a part to play in the movement. And I just so happens that I am really good at making jewelry, and I understand how to make ceramics, and it's just my way of playing my role in the movement, I think. You never know what you might be good at. You're a fantastic radio personality. Some people are really great bloggers. You know, some people are really, you know, great at baking. Maybe we need some skeptical bakers, too.
I would buy skeptical cookies.
Skeptical cookie makers. We need just everyone to get involved. Whatever it is that your specialty is, I think that you can help spread the word.
That is fantastic.
We're just doing our part. We're good at making jewelry, so that's what we're doing.
So tell us a little bit about the actual products. What are some of the designs?
Well, I'll tell you about some of our most popular in our smart jewelry line. We have done a Charles Darwin piece It was based on the illustration. It's a reproduction of the illustration that he did in Origin of Species. It was a little drawing that he was trying to explain, you know, how species came into existence. And it's a lovely little drawing. And so we've done a reproduction of that. That's been really popular. And we've done a few pieces for the atheist movement, too. We noticed that there was a void. You can find a lot of crosses, but there was never a beautiful necklace for an atheist. So we went ahead and we designed that, too. And then we've also done some of the pieces, like, say, the Out campaign piece, the A. We did that, a reproduction of that. That's been very popular. And then we have I Doubt It and Question Everything, and we have a Scientific Method piece. Lots of stuff.
There's one with a microscope on it, even.
Mm-hmm.
They're beautiful.
Yeah.
I actually I have two of your pieces. The one with
you have the Use Your Brain is a very popular one. I believe
love
you have
the
that.
Use Your Brain, which is really, you know, it is kind of awkward sometimes though, because the brain it says use right below it, and it sort of hangs at sort of a point on my chest that makes people come nearer, which is not always appropriate.
See, that's perfect. That's the whole idea. And that opens up the dialogue so you can explain what the skeptical movement's all about. Then we can get more people. It'll be great.
I love it. So I'm sure that other people want to get in on the skeptical accessory action. So where can they go to find it?
Well, for one thing, we're going to be at TAM next week. So if anyone is going to be at TAM, please come say hello to us. We would love to have more friends. And you can always find us online at surlyramix.com. And we have two online stores, one on Etsy, surly.etsy.com, and surly on artfire.com as well.
Perfect.
So we're always available there.
Well, that's perfect. Thanks so much for being on the show,
hello.
Amy. Oh, can you still hear me?
Yep. Thanks, Amy.
Okay, thanks, Amy.
Okay. Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and I do have to say one thing, Amy. You don't sound very surly.
When I'm approached by pseudoscience and crazy people, I get surly, I swear.
Perfect. Thanks so much, and we will see you at TAM.
Thank you.
Yay, see you.
Bye.
Bye.
So next up, we'll be speaking with Jeff Richardson about storm chasing. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this short commercial break. Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time at 780-492-2577 extension 1. That's 780-492-2577 extension 1. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Skeptically Speaking is also rebroadcast on Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Citywide LP 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show. Hello, everyone. You are back with Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking about storms and the people who chase them. We are on the line with Jeff Richardson, all the way from Oklahoma. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How are you? Thanks for being on the show.
Well, it's great to be here.
Perfect.
And it looks like up there it's a rather comfortable 19 degrees.
Thank you, Mr. Weather Person. Jeff is a storm chaser. He's had a lifelong interest in geosciences in general and meteorology in particular. And since the spring of 1982, he has annually documented and observed severe weather events throughout Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, and Kansas. His interests include thunderstorms and tornadoes, damage surveys, mesoscale meteorology, and numerical weather forecasting models, which are all far more interesting than long walks on the beach. So, Jeff, what exactly is a storm chaser?
Well, there's really a lot of definitions by that, but basically a storm chaser can be anything from a a research meteorologist who's actually going out into the field on a formal research project with a lot of meteorological instruments. And it could also be someone like myself who's just had a lifelong interest in weather, and the best way to go out and be a sort of a citizen scientist, if you will, is to actually go out into the field and watch these things take place. And a lot of storm chasers are what are called spotters. And they are people that actually go out and are in communication with the local weather service office and sort of the eyes and ears of the meteorologists that are watching the radar.
So this is something that you actually do in coordination with the weather office. This is not simply a hobby. You're actually helping them out.
Right. Right. The public safety is a very important issue in this because they do like a set of eyes out in the field actually watching the storm and seeing what's actually taking place.
Well, you know, storm watching is not something, you know, that it doesn't come to your window and you just sit there and watch it. You actually go out and find the storms, which is potentially quite dangerous.
Well, it's interesting that you would mention the danger part of that, because it's true that a storm chaser who's going to do this successfully really has to learn how to forecast, because you can't always just simply rely on the forecasts that are put out by the well, here in the States, the National Weather Service, or in Canada, the Meteorological Service of Canada. You really need to know how to interpret the weather on your own. And that's important. On the danger element, actually the greatest danger to us is simply being out on the highways. And that can be in very nice weather, the roads are dry, the weather's clear, great visibility, but that's actually your greatest danger.
Right.
Is just simply being out on the roads.
So if it's so dangerous, you know, honestly, what in the world would make you want to do that?
Well, it's for the same reason that people might take a trip to see the Grand Canyon, or they might go see some of the great architectural achievements in the world, you know, a structure like the Great Wall of China or Notre Dame in France. To go out onto the Great Plains and look at what's called a supercell thunderstorm that is twice the height of Mount Everest, that is a very, very compelling sight.
Well,
these storms operate on the energy level of several nuclear power plants combined.
See, this is exactly what I'm saying. See, those first two can't kill you. The last one can.
Right. Well, that's where the knowledge of storm structure and storm behavior comes into play. And also keeping in mind, you know, where you are in relation to the road network of where you're currently located. And there are certain portions of the country that are vulnerable to tornadoes that chasers like myself prefer to go, because the road networks are very predictable and reliable. The roads are well maintained. And there are other areas where there's lots of hills and trees, and you can really get in trouble in a place like that because your visibility is very poor.
Well, okay, let's go back here. When I first announced this show, I had people email me, honestly, almost immediately, wanting you to take them storm chasing.
Right.
So you're in Oklahoma, so that's difficult. But How do you go about this? Start right at step one. So you want to chase a storm.
Okay. Just very, very briefly. I do most of my own forecasting. I'll take a little bit of information from the National Weather Service and look at computer models, which basically are part of some of the most powerful computers in the world that are used to forecast weather. I take that information and information from maps that create kind of a three-dimensional picture in my mind of what I think is going to happen during the day. And then I essentially come up with what I call a target area. And that's an area that could be, you know, a few hundred square miles, where that's an area that maybe it's a 200 or 300 mile drive, and that's where I want to go because I think that's where storms might initiate sometime later in the day. Now, once I'm on my way out there, I may have to check on weather data to see if things have changed in the meantime and adjust that target area appropriately. And once I'm there to the target area, it's a lot of hurry up and wait, because sometimes there are certain ingredients in the recipe that just don't get there at the right moment, and your souffle falls.
That was a beautiful analogy.
And that can happen, and that happens quite often. And when that does happen, that's what we call a bust. When you go out and you see maybe just a few weak thunderstorms, or you stare at puffy clouds and mostly clear blue skies, that's called a bust. And bust happens quite often.
Well, actually, let's talk about the ones that aren't a bust. Tell me some juicy storm chasing stories.
Well, one of the most prolific events that I've ever been on is well known to many storm chasers here in the States, and that was the May 3rd, 1999 tornado outbreak, which was a massive outbreak in Oklahoma and south central Kansas. In fact, to date, it's the largest tornado outbreak in the state of Oklahoma's history. And that day started out as what's known as a slight risk. In other words, there's a slight risk for severe thunderstorms and tornadoes. By early afternoon, the Storm Prediction Center in Norman, Oklahoma, had raised it up to a moderate risk. And I began to notice by other information, weather data that I was getting, that things were starting to look a little more interesting. Well, later on by mid-afternoon, it had gone to a high risk. Now, high risks are relatively rare, but considering all the conditions that were coming into place, and there was one parameter in particular that's called convective available potential energy, or the acronym is CAPE. And the CAPE that afternoon had reached a level of 5,000. Now, a day that has a CAPE of 2,500 to 3,000, that's pretty high CAPE. But to get up to about 5,000 or higher is very rare. And that means that the atmosphere is just like a keg of dynamite. The fuse is lit, and it's just a matter of time before it goes off. And that day, I saw five separate distinct tornadoes. It was amazing, to say the least. The one thunderstorm that I was watching that day produced 20 separate tornadoes in its lifespan, which is probably not an official record, but it's extremely rare that one thunderstorm would produce that many tornadoes. And some of them were very weak and just lasted literally a few seconds.
But they're still tornadoes.
Absolutely. It's still a tornado. It's still officially documented. And those weak tornadoes can kill people, and they have. The most notorious event that happened that day was the big, massive tornado that moved through the Oklahoma City metropolitan area and caused over $1 billion in damage and killed about 38 people. And there were probably close to maybe 1,200 injuries. There were literally literally thousands upon thousands of homes that were destroyed, and it was really an unprecedented event, and massive violent tornadoes like that hitting metropolitan areas are very rare, but they do occur, and unfortunately that did occur that day.
Callers, if you have any questions for Jeff Richardson, Storm Chaser, do call in 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email a question to live@skepticallyspeaking.com or on Twitter at Skeptical Radio. So, would you actually say that this was like Twister? Because I saw that movie and I really liked that movie.
No.
Not
I
at
mean,
all.
God, Twister,
you're killing my dreams, Jeff. There's no cow in front of your car?
Well, this is the skeptic in me. I'm going to burst some bubbles here deliberately.
That's what we're all about.
Twister really, you know, it's fine. It's fun. It's entertainment. It's Hollywood, but that's just what it is. It's Hollywood. The real thing, real life, is completely different. I mean, even our reality shows are rather scripted. No kidding. No, I was dragged kicking and screaming to see Twister because I just knew that I was not going to be able to sit through this, but I watched it deliberately, and there's a lot of very inaccurate things in it. The way the tornadoes behave, the way the debris flew through the air. People always talk about the cows flying through the air. And yes, large animals do become airborne in a tornado, but not in that manner, where you see them flying and mooing and their legs or tails are kicking out all over the place. And to, you know, have three or four big tornadoes, like in Twister, you know, occur right in front of you in a, you know, a 24-hour period is just unheard of. So for entertainment value, it's fine, but in realistic terms, it's way off.
Fair enough.
Well, it's
nothing like reality.
Sounds like you might be trying to get away from the Twister questions, but I have an email question on the same page. Have you ever done that thing they did in Twister where they take a whole bunch of little sensor pod thingies and drop them into the eye of the storm, thus learning the true shape of the storm?
Well, there's nothing like that that's ever actually ever been done. There have been some instruments that have been put in the place of a tornado, some by official research meteorologist. There was actually a little instrument package that was used back in the 1980s. It was called Toto, named after the little dog in The Wizard of Oz. And that had a few close calls. And there have been some other little instrument packages in recent years that have been put in place, but nothing like in the movie. No, nothing like that at all.
Well, somebody should get on that then, I think.
Actually, you know, you bring up the eye of the storm. Is that, I've heard that concept, but is there a calm place in the middle of a storm?
Yeah, well, that's really a, kind of a complex question to answer because that depends upon the structure of the tornado vortex itself. Some tornado vortexes may be like a very large hose or a tube. And in the middle, if this passes over you, you may experience somewhat of a rather quiet calm. And of course, when the other side of that vortex tube reaches you, you'll notice the wind's picking up and it'll get much noisier and you hear debris flying. And so there may be some truth to that.
But it's not something that you can sort of run along inside and stay out of harm's way.
No, there is no way, even in the weakest of tornadoes, that you would want to expose yourself to something like that, because even if there's not a lot of debris, the wind will pick you up and throw you. I mean, you'll be seriously injured no matter what.
Well, I have to say you are convincing some of our listeners. One of our listeners just tweeted us that, sorry, guys, if that big storm comes before you finish, I'm going to have to go chase it now. So you've already won their loyalty.
Well done.
But I do have an email question as well. In your estimation, are the number and severity of storms increasing as the global temperature increases, a la global warming?
That was one of my questions.
That's a good question. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me with the climate change that is taking place, it wouldn't surprise me if there was a change, and not just in severe thunderstorms and tornadoes, but in the frequency of other events, such as hurricanes, even winter weather events as well. So it's really difficult to tell. Right now, we need a little more data. It may be a few more years and perhaps a few more decades before we can really tell, because to get a really accurate idea of what's taking place long term, you really need some long term climate data. But personally, I'm thinking that it is going to have an effect. To what extent or the severity of it, it's still a little too early to tell. And weather, again, is very erratic and difficult to predict in many ways, because you're dealing with a fluid. And fluids act in very weird ways. That gets into an area of physics called fluid dynamics. And fluids are very unpredictable.
So how does, you know, speaking of unpredictable, how does a regular storm turn into something like a hurricane or a tornado?
Well, in hurricanes, basically what happens is, what often happens during the height of the hurricane season is a cluster of thunderstorms will come off the west coast of Africa. And if the conditions are just right, where the air flowing into the bottom of the storms is pretty balanced with the air flowing out of the top of the storms, an area of low pressure can be created. And if this can maintain itself across the Atlantic for thousands of miles, it can turn into a tropical storm and then eventually mature into what we call a hurricane. In thunderstorms, it's a little more complex, because there's actually different types of thunderstorms. There's the simple, what we call an air mass thunderstorm, that just forms during the heat of the day and then dissipates very quickly. There's other types of storms called squall lines, where you have a long line of thunderstorms. And these can travel literally hundreds of miles across several states or provinces, and usually mostly they'll deliver a lot of high winds and heavy rain and some hail. And then you have the holy grail of thunderstorms that chasers like myself prefer, which are called supercell thunderstorms. And these thunderstorms are almost like miniature weather systems within themselves, where they have very complex structures. And they can last for hours and hours and be very prolific hail producers, hail up to the size of, a softball, hail that, literally will do severe damage to structures, flash floods that can occur very quickly. And in fact, flash flooding, or flooding in general, is the number one weather killer among people. It's not lightning or tornadoes, right, or hurricanes. It's flooding. And, of course, supercell thunderstorms are the thunderstorms most likely to produce tornadoes as well.
Well, on the topic of storm survival, I do have a question that regards to if there's a tornado in your area, you should open all of the... It is said that you should open all the windows, lest the pressure differential crush the house like an egg, or else you suffocate somehow. He's guessing it's not true. What are your thoughts?
Well, we can bust that myth right now. That's a complete myth. there have been documented with instruments a pressure drop within a tornado because it is an area of low pressure. But the thought of moving just a few panes of thin glass to equalize pressure to save a house has a certain degree of absurdity to it. Because if a tornado is approaching a structure, most structures leak a lot of air to begin with, so the pressure will not be an issue anyway. But by the time that tornado gets there, either through straight line winds or flying debris, those windows are already going to be broken out anyway. And there's probably going to be holes punched in the roof or the walls. So that's an old myth that lasted well into probably the mid to late 1970s. But it's a complete myth. There's no truth to that at all.
Great.
Fair enough. As there are so many others with tornadoes.
Well, speaking of myths, I have a Twitter listener from Ontario who has another probably myth-related question. They want to get back to the topic of movies. They said, what is the best weather-related film and the worst? And they're assuming the worst might be The Day After Tomorrow.
I vote worst.
Well, yeah, The Day After Tomorrow probably would be a pretty good candidate. And, you know, believe it or not, I would say The Wizard of Oz might not be a bad candidate for one of the best. Because there actually have been tornadoes, and there's actually a tornado that was caught on film by a research crew from the University of Oklahoma that's known as the Wizard of Oz tornado, because it looked and behaved very much like the tornado in The Wizard of Oz. And in The Wizard of Oz movie, of course, you know, that the house of Dorothy Inn is actually picked up literally intact off the foundation and moved. And that actually has happened. I've seen and photographed houses that have been blown off the foundation and sat down
perfectly,
you know, with damage, but
yeah.
You know, you probably could have ridden out the storm, but that occurs basically in very weak tornadoes on houses that are very poorly attached to the foundation.
Interesting. Okay, now, again, I know we're getting lots of emails, and that's lovely, but if there's anyone who would actually like to be on the phone line, and if you phone in, we'll use your name. That's the benefit you get. It's 780-492-2577, extension 1, or live at skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you tweet at Skeptical Radio. So I believe we have another email question.
Yes, we do. The listener asks, I heard that the Fujita scale was redefined. If so, in what way?
That's correct. And the Fujita scale was fantastic. Dr. Theodore Fujita is, to meteorology and severe weather research specifically, probably one of the equivalents of an Albert Einstein. I mean, he absolutely revolutionized tornado research. And after a tornado in Lubbock, Texas in 1970, he devised what was called the Fujita scale of tornado intensity. And this was based on mostly damage to residential homes at the ground level. Now, after some outbreaks in the late 1990s, most notably the big outbreak that I mentioned earlier in May of 1999 in Oklahoma and Kansas, some engineers and meteorologists began to reevaluate the Fujita scale and began to think, you know, really, maybe we should reevaluate this and update it a bit. And even Professor Fujita himself was aware of the shortcomings of his scale. So what was done was, there were 28, I believe it's 28 damage indicators or degrees of damage that are now used on the enhanced Fujita scale. And that essentially goes anywhere from very minor damage to vegetation to very severe damage to steel-reinforced structural buildings. And it also helps in the fact that it reduced literally the wind speeds that are necessary to do a lot of damage. Because with the old Fujita scale, we thought, well, to do damage that might sweep a well-constructed frame home off a foundation and scatter the debris over, say, more than a mile, may take winds of close to 300 miles an hour. Well, now we know from research done in the past 10 years that a neighborhood of well-constructed homes and well-constructed commercial buildings can be very severely damaged and structures leveled in winds even as low as 160 miles an hour. And that's one of the advantages of the enhanced Fujita scale, is that it revised completely and helps us to get a better idea of the true wind speeds in the tornado and what's actually happening to the structures.
So back about, oh God, it might have been 20 years ago now, Edmonton had quite a large tornado. And when you and I spoke before the show, you mentioned that Edmonton had made the cover of a magazine.
Right. This was back in, I believe, probably 1988. There's a great weather magazine out there. In fact, it's probably the only general publication or general public magazine on weather that I'm aware of. It's called WeatherWise. And on the cover of one of the 1988 editions was a fantastic photograph of the Edmonton tornado.
You're welcome.
And that tornado is, in terms of Canadian weather history, one of the watershed events.
So what would it have been on the Fujita scale?
If I remember correctly, that was rated on the old Fujita scale as an F4. And probably still might have been rated as a EF4 on the enhanced Fujita scale, maybe an EF3. Well, I would bet that today it probably would be rated as an EF3 today.
So centerfold material is what you're saying.
Right.
Okay.
Still centerfold material, no matter what.
Well, I was kind of wondering in terms of tornadoes, just how often it is that, you know, a tornado does impact a large metropolitan area to that extent. You know, obviously hurricanes and stuff, different climate, but how about tornado damage? Is that fairly common in frequency?
Well, it's relatively rare, and there's a good reason for that. First of all, major metropolitan areas, in spite of what we think, actually cover a very small percentage of real estate. You know, if you think about large metro areas, Edmonton, Winnipeg, you know, Kansas City, Minneapolis, Omaha, Chicago, Indianapolis, Tulsa, Dallas, Oklahoma City, Wichita, so on. If you put all those areas together, still they would comprise a rather small area. Now, for something like a typical tornado, which may be 200 to 300 feet wide at the base and last 5 to 10 minutes with a path length of maybe 5 or 7 miles, the chances of something that small hitting a major metropolitan area are very, very small.
Thank you. We are going to go to a short commercial break, and we will be right back with more of Jeff Richardson talking about storm chasing. Next time on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking about cults with Dr. Stephen Kent, who's done extensive research on new and alternative religions. He's been consulted on legal cases concerning Scientology, Satanism, and ritual abuse. He'll explain what drives otherwise rational people to join cults, how brainwashing works, and the difference between religions and cults. And if that sounds familiar, it's because it is. We're airing a rerun because we'll all be in Las Vegas at the Amazing Meeting, the world's biggest skeptical gathering.
We'll return the following week with our stories and some short interviews with skeptics from around the globe. Until then, love from the gang at Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time, here on CJSR. Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. We're talking about storm chasing with Jeff Richardson. And I have some statements here that I want to read about tornadoes.
Go right ahead.
So just tell me if these are true or not. So tornadoes can suck water from swimming pools.
Wrong.
Damn it. Okay.
Did I burst your bubble on that?
Repeatedly. This show does that. It's fine.
No, that does not happen. In fact, I'll quickly tell you a story. The first tornado I ever saw in my entire life happened here in Tulsa on December the 5th, 1975. Imagine that, a tornado in December, you know, less than 3 weeks before Christmas. And this tornado moved over an area where there were duplexes, and there was a swimming pool in the middle of them. After the storm, people noticed the swimming pool was empty. Well, there was a rumor going around that, you know, 20 or 30 gallons of water had been sucked away. Well, of course, the swimming pool had been emptied for the winter. And, you know, duh, that would make sense.
That would.
But no, the you know, if a tornado did move over some swimming pool, yes, the winds might blow some of the water off the top of the water, but it will not suck, you know, tens of thousands of gallons of water out and deposit it somewhere down the street. It doesn't happen.
So another possible myth, mobile homes attract tornadoes. Now, actually, before we talk about that, does anyone remember that WKRP episode? Since we are on the radio, I have to ask about WKRP. In the episode, there was a tornado, and Dr. Johnny Fever was asking why God hates mobile homes.
I remember that.
See, and Johnny Fever wanted Les Nessman to do an emergency warning, but Les only had a script written for when the communists invaded. So if anybody in our audience knows what Dr. Johnny Fever told Les Nessman to substitute the word tornado for, email or call that in, and if you're the first one, we will send you a prize. So, again, sorry, the number is 780-492-2577, extension 1, live at skepticallyspeaking.com or on Twitter at Skeptical Radio. So, again, my question is, do mobile homes attract tornadoes?
No, they don't. But the reason that you see a lot of damage from mobile homes is because they're very good at detecting damage from strong winds, simply because of the way they're made. You know, their modular structure. Nothing against anybody that lives in them, but they're not very well put together,
and they don't have basements.
It doesn't take a lot of wind to turn one over, even if those things are anchored down. So even if very weak tornadoes move through an area, and there happen to be a mobile home park, or even a mobile home just out in the middle of nowhere, you're going to notice damage on that structure that may have been attributed to straight line winds if it was on a frame house.
Gotcha.
Okay, I do have another myth here that involves tornadoes by email. Why is the southwest part of the basement the safest place to hide from tornadoes, assuming that's true?
Well, the southwest part of the basement is not the most safest place.
Debunked.
And that was another myth that was going strong probably up until the mid-1960s. Because it was assumed that if you got on the southwest part of the basement, that all of the debris and everything that's inside the house would get blown to the northeast, and you would be in the clear. Well, after a tornado in Topeka, Kansas in 1966, damage survey crews went in and looked at a lot of the houses, and as it turned out, a lot of homes that had basements were shifted to the northeast, and as they were shifted, the southwest part of the house actually collapsed in on top of the southwest part of the basement. And in some cases, people were actually killed by taking shelter in the southwest part of the basement.
And this is what you get for not questioning people.
Right. It's what you get for not being a skeptic.
Thank you, Jeff. Well put.
Being a skeptic will save your life. You
Absolutely.
Heard it first here.
So, okay, well, let's continue on with the myths. Now, I'm not sure about this one because I actually read this in a newspaper probably about a year and a half ago. It said a woman was sitting on her couch talking on her cell phone, and it was during a storm, and she was hit by lightning inside her house. Could that actually be possible?
Well, that could be possible depending on where she was sitting in the house. Now, cell phones generally, or even a cordless phone, would be safe because you're not directly connected to a line that's going to the outside of the house. Now, there's a possibility that she could have been near an electrical outlet, and the lightning can actually come through an electrical outlet out into the room and strike you.
That's frightening.
Or she could be, you know, she could have been near a window, or she could have been very near a electrical cord or in contact with something that was in contact with an electrical cord. Lightning can do very weird things. You know, if you're in a building that's struck by lightning, it can do weird, strange stuff. Lightning's fascinating. Fascinating but deadly. And it's the number two killer behind floods.
So on that note, how can we avoid Mother Nature's wrath?
Well, moving to the moon would be a good option.
Great.
Barring that, you know, you mentioned that to me the other day, and I thought about that a while. And I thought, you know, if you want to still live in North America, there's not very many places that you can go where you will be completely safe. Because if you want a milder climate, you can go to maybe some place like San Francisco. But then you're in a hotbed of seismic activity, which one of these days is going to really cut loose. You could go maybe to Alaska, but they're also prone to earthquakes and incredibly long winters. Same for, you know, much of Canada, you have long winters up there, very cold. If you go to, you know, the desert southwest in the United States, you're dealing with hot weather. The entire coastal region of the United States from, you know, Brownsville, Texas, all the way up to Maine is susceptible to hurricanes. And, of course, here in the you know, the plains of the United States and Canada, quite vulnerable to severe thunderstorms and tornadoes. So I don't know. You know, even Hawaii gets the occasional you know, tropical event out there, you know, a hurricane. So
you're screwed is what we're saying.
I'm thinking gosh,
that's okay.
That's a good question. You know,
well, while you ponder the possibilities, we do have a caller, Kevin from Edmonton. Are you there?
Hi.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi. One of the things that I kind of keep running across is the stories of like fish falls and frog falls, and apparently there was one in Tokyo not too long ago. And is there like any evidence that these actually occur? And, like, have you, seen any?
You're talking about fish or frogs actually falling from the sky.
Yeah. And some people think that kind of one of the hypotheses of this is that it's caused by, like tornadoes or whirlwinds kind of, like, scooping them up.
Well, you know, I don't have any definite information on that, to be honest. But I've heard stories about that in the past. And there may be some truth to the fact that a, you know, exceptionally violent tornado may have moved over a body of water where there were fish or some kind of amphibians very close to the surface, and it could have taken a large number of these up, and in the process of moving near to or over a landmass, depositing this water and these very lightweight animals that just happen to have the misfortune of getting caught up in the vortex. So it's possible.
Perfect. Thank you, caller.
Yep, thanks. Bye.
Thank you. All right, we'll jump to another email here. Does the energy from the sun, as seen from the aurora borealis, affect the storm energy formation or only lightning, or is it neither? I saw a documentary that claimed the sun had once been much more active and created superstorms in ancient times.
Well, that's a really good question. There's been some research into sunspots, for example, and how that might affect climate. And solar weather certainly could have effects. That's an area that, to be honest, I don't know much about. And I wish I knew more about. You know, it's one of those areas where I'm constantly learning about more about weather.
Well, as skeptics, we always prefer that people, you know, admit when they're lacking
don't
in the knowledge
and
admit that there's always new things to go out and explore.
So. New things to learn.
Yes.
So, okay, now this is going to sound like a very rude question, but it's probably the last question. If nobody calls in, again, it's 780-492-2577, extension 1, and you better have a quick question. So, there seems to be a bit of a lack of accuracy in weather forecasting.
Sure.
Why is that?
I completely understand that. It all goes back to the fact that we're dealing with this very volatile, erratic, unpredictable fluid that's this ocean of air that we live at the bottom of. And it's very difficult to predict, not just with, you know, our brains and our head, but even using some of the most powerful computers that exist. Some of these supercomputers will often come out with very conflicting information on what forecasters have to use to make a forecast. And so forecasters are dealing with, you know, maybe 6 or 8 different viewpoints coming out from the computers. They have to take that information, put it together with their own hand analysis of maps, and, you know, discussing amongst themselves what they think will take place, and plus just a little bit of gut instinct and intuition and remembering what happened in the past and are there any patterns like what they're seeing now and have we seen this in the past and what happened back then. So it's true, you know, forecast accuracy is probably, well, let's say 70%, somewhere in that range. And actually, that's doing pretty good.
I was going to say you may be being charitable
yeah,
there, but
fair
we
enough.
Do have a caller.
Nathan, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay.
Hi,
Nathan.
I just got a real quick, actually not really a question, just a comment. You were talking about the Edmonton Twister earlier, and it was on July 31st of 1987. And at the time, it was classified as an F4. And I just want to thank Jeff for doing what he does, because it's going to save lives.
And it's darn cool.
Wonderful.
Exactly.
Thank you, Nathan.
Thanks for calling.
Bye.
So I believe that's all the time we have for today.
Yes, I think that might even be a new record for Nathan for like
he was
speed.
The last caller.
And it was very fast.
Ooh,
not that he takes long questions. It was just, you know.
Absolutely.
Extra. Okay.
Okay.
Anything else?
that is all the time we have.
If there's one thing I can put in real quick is do not get in a car and try to outrun a tornado, or don't get under an overpass.
No overpasses?
No overpasses.
All right. That's fair. I hope everyone's paying attention to this.
Yes.
So thank you very much, Jeff, for being on the show today. That was lovely.
Thank you, Desiree and Sean. It was a true delight. I really enjoyed this.
You know, I find it interesting. You're very relaxed for someone who I was assuming would be an adrenaline junkie.
No, I'm not.
No, I see that. You're very calm.
I'm not an adrenaline junkie. I hate that. And people may think, you know, that storm chasing is just one bit of excitement after another, and it isn't. It's a lot of windshield time. You've got to love being out in the middle of nowhere on a dirt road for hours on end.
Well, we mentioned reality shows earlier. Perhaps maybe it's not really reality show material in the end, I guess.
No, it really isn't.
Dude sitting in a car looking out his windshield, I'm riveted.
You learn to talk to the cows a lot.
Nice. You know. Okay, well, thanks again to Jeff for being here, and thanks to Amy for speaking up about Surly Ramix. And remember, audience, it's rerun time next week, as we'll all be at the amazing meeting. But the week after that, we'll be back with lots of stories and mini interviews with the lovely skeptics that we met there.
And when we get to town, we do invite you to come say hi. We want to meet our listeners and get to know who you are. So we look forward to seeing your lovely faces once we get to town.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Well, anyway, we'll see you next week. We will share our lovely stories then. Next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Good night, everyone.
South America does not exist. The moon is painted on the sky. Things sometimes fall up, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. All the hippies are working for the government, and everything you believe is a lie.
Bye.